So our reading this morning is taken from Mark's Gospel, chapter 12, and it will come up on the screen for you to follow. Then Jesus spoke to them in parables. Once there was a man who planted a vineyard, put a fence round it, dug a hole for the wine press, and built a watchtower. And he rented the vineyard to tenants and left home on a trip. When the time came to gather the grapes, he sent a servant to the tenants to receive from them his share of the harvest. The tenants grabbed the servant, beat him, and sent him back without a thing. Then the owner sent another servant. The tenants beat him over the head and treated him shamefully. The owner sent a third one, and they killed him. They treated many others the same way, beating some and killing others. Last of all, then, he sent his son to the tenants. "I'm sure they will respect my son," he said. But those tenants said to one another, "This is the owner's son. Come on, let's kill him, and his property will be ours." So they grabbed the son and killed him and threw his body out of the vineyard. And Jesus asked, "What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and turn the vineyard over to others." Surely you've read this scripture. The stone which the builders rejected as worthless turned out to be the most important of all. This was done by the Lord. What a wonderful sight it is. Jewish leaders tried to arrest Jesus because they knew that he had told this parable against them, but they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and they went away. You often hear these days about people wanting to get on the property ladder, wanting to own their own place. In London, private rents are expensive, so if you want a 3-bed property in Mayfair, in central London, it will cost you £13,700 a month on average. Or you might want to go a little bit cheaper than that. So perhaps the cheapest place for a 3-bed place is Abbey Wood to the southeast. That will cost you £1,285, a lot more money than other parts of the country. So depending on what you earn, that can be a lot of money. And if you can get a council flat or find somewhere with a social landlord, like a housing association, then it's just a fraction of the cost. Did you know that back in the mid-1980s, there were about 5 million properties belonging to social landlords? But then the Conservative government introduced Right to Buy, and by 2005, just 20 years later, the number had fallen below 4 million. That's a big drop in such a short time. Those who exercised their right to buy bought their places for less than £40,000 where we were in South London. These were 2-bed flats. And then proceeded to rent them out at hugely inflated prices. I came across that time and again. It was supposed to be their home, but they thought this is a chance to make money. And now there's a push to build social housing again. But 2 years ago, they only managed 5,000, 0.5%. of the million that were lost. So whether you're a tenant or an owner matters quite a lot. Not that being an owner is a bed of roses, that said, when you see the damage wreaked by the recent floods, then having your own property could cost you dear if your insurers don't cough up properly. But this morning I want you to take that image into this parable by Jesus, tenant or owner. Now, the parable wasn't new. If we could just take the first slide, please. Isaiah had used something pretty similar in Isaiah chapter 5. Take the next click. And in that parable, the owner is depicted as God, and the vineyard is God's people, Israel. And when God comes looking for fruit, he doesn't find it. And so the prophet Isaiah rails against the people and says, "You're a vineyard, you're supposed to produce fruit. You're supposed to be this light to the nations," and so on. But there were new ingredients. If you could click again, there were new ingredients in Jesus' version of the parable. In it, the tenants were introduced. These were the religious leaders of the day. Servants came to remonstrate with the tenants. These clearly were the prophets and John the Baptist, and ultimately the Son comes, which is a reference to Jesus himself. It's one of those parables which they say is more like an allegory, where lots and lots of little details correspond to particular people and things. Jesus was describing Israel's political religious leaders as tenants who would not pay their rent. Now, over the years with the housing thing, I've come across a lot of criminality. I remember one couple who were living together, and in the course of conversation with them, this was in Southwark, it turned out that this was her council flat and that he had his own council flat in Lambeth. But it worked better for them to live together in Southwark and for him to sublet his council flat in Lambeth for £100 a week. That was quite cheap back in those days, obviously. It was illegal for him to do that. If he had a council property, he should have been living in it himself. And there are rules in the tenancy agreement that you can't just sublet it like that. The son, I think, did a thing saying, shop a scrounger. We'll give you £20 if you can shop a scrounger. I could have made quite a lot of money from the people I met, although you can kind of understand that people at the bottom of the pile very often grab at anything where they can make money. Southwark Council, where we were living in those days, back in the late 80s, early 90s, was failing to collect their rent. People weren't paying it, and they weren't doing a very good job chasing it up. At one point, they had 33 million in rent arrears. And here were people who lived in their flats, were not paying their rent, and wanted to live like owners and not like tenants. And that's the distinction you need to get hold of. They wanted all the benefits of having a property, but none of the responsibilities that go with it. And anybody who's read a tenancy agreement will see that there are things that hold on both sides, things that we must do. So that's the point of this parable. The religious leaders were like tenants, entrusted by God with the leadership of the nation and ultimately accountable to God. He was looking for a return from their leadership. He was looking for a people who were increasingly a light to the nations, and the leaders would set that tone, ideally. But they wanted to remove that accountability and live like owners. They enjoyed the power that they had, and they didn't want to relinquish it. And so you have this carefully crafted allegory, which clearly the Jewish leaders could see where Jesus was going with this, and at the end of the passage we read said that they wanted to get rid of him and kill him. So let's take another slide, another picture. It's a picture of wholesale slaughter in the parable. And this is the parable itself, verses 1 to 7, and this is verse 7. Israel is the vineyard of the Lord Almighty, the people of Judah are the vines he planted. He expected them to do what was good, but instead they committed murder. He expected them to do what was right, but their victims cried out for justice. So let's take the next slide. So the owner sends servants and they get beaten and killed. Clear enough reference to the prophets and even John the Baptist. And finally he sends his son. They perhaps assumed that his father was now dead. That's the reason why he's come, perhaps. And so they figure that if they kill him, they can complete their takeover bid. If we kill him, the vineyard will be ours, they say. But they didn't realise the owner is not dead, and he wreaks a terrible revenge on them. The allegory of murder and judgment points to the imminent rejection and execution of Jesus and to the terrible destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, which Jesus described as the judgment of God on Israel's disobedience. Okay, enough of the picture, thank you. Now, this story connects with our lives in all sorts of ways. We are tenants, we are not owners. Andrew referred to Boris Johnson in his prayer. Boris Johnson, amazingly, won a big election victory, and in many ways wasn't expected to get such a sizable majority. A lot has been said about how votes from the north of England have been loaned to the Conservatives, and how there's an accountability thing there. If things don't get better in the north over the next 5 years, then those votes will certainly be withdrawn. But there is that higher accountability all the time. We are accountable to the people, but we are also accountable to God. And as you encounter politicians, there is that issue of conscience that sometimes politicians will not follow the government line simply because there's a higher accountability that they are not prepared to betray. Being a parent is also a case of you being a tenant, not an owner. We like to think that our kids are our kids. They're my kids. But actually, are they? Or are they actually on loan to us from God? So that we prepare them for life, and then when the time comes, let them go. It's a difficult thing to do that. But often we, as parents, see ourselves as owners rather than being entrusted with the care and being prepared to let that child go as they grow. And churches can be a place where ownership creeps in instead of that sense of being tenants and being accountable. 11 years ago, I preached at the induction service of a colleague locally, and some of you were there. And I decided to take this passage on that occasion. And my strap line was, "This is not your church." Now, it's traditional in an induction service that you give a charge to the minister and a charge to the church. And in the old days, when Baptists were first on the scene, these services would go on a long time. I was saying to Andrew and Hannah, you could often see an induction service going on for 5 hours, and it would include very long hymns, which would be sung in their entirety. And then a sermon for the minister, the new minister, which would go on for an hour or more, and then a sermon for the church for an hour or more. And meanwhile, the young people, the Baptist young people, will gather outside and begin to form relationships and potential marriages and so on. It was quite an interesting system. Anyway, I had to do a combined charge to the minister and the church. So first up, I spoke to the minister and I said, "What I want you to know is this is not your church." Because 10 years down the line, you're going to refer to this as my church, but it's not. It's not your church. It's an amazing thing being a minister. Sometimes I recommend it and sometimes I don't recommend it. Unless you feel called, I would never recommend the job to you. It's an immense privilege. You get to take people's weddings and you get to speak at people's funerals. And that's an enormous privilege. And people share their stories and even their secrets with you. And perhaps you've not known them that long, but because of your position, they come and share these things. And so over time, you get to know people in a way that other people in the congregation don't know them. Then there's a challenge to ministry. We were talking about this in our home groups last week, that what's the measure of church? Is it aggregation or congregation? A subtle difference between those two words. Aggregation is all about numbers. Congregation is much more about relationships. But the bottom line so often in church is that we want to see numbers. We're not that bothered about relationships. God probably sees things quite differently. And so the challenge is to build the church all the time. And within a context like ours in Newham, where there is so much diversity, 93% of people in Newham apparently sign up to one religion or another. And that compares with a country where something like 57% of this country now say that they're not aligned to any religion at all. So it's challenging. There's a price to ministry. I said to the minister, they will blame you when you get it wrong. And when you get it right, they will be silent. Funny feature of church life, but it happens like that. And then there's an expectation. People expect things of you. And they particularly expect you to fill the church. Alan Redpath, a preacher from years ago, some of you may have heard of him, said that when he was in the vestry before a service, there was always a deacon who came in, who was one of those kind of half-empty people. So he'd come in and say, "Mr. Redpath, the church is half empty." And it was always that kind of, you know, everything was down rather than up. And Redpath got really annoyed with him. And always he was sort of putting these things in at deacons' meetings, negative comments all the time. And in the end he thought, I'm going to write this bloke a letter and I'm going to blast him for the way he's been speaking to me all these years. And he made the mistake, having written the letter, of asking his wife whether she'd like to just read it through before he sent it. And she said, rather than send the letter, why don't you just pray for him? And he said, I knew you were going to say that. I don't know why I showed you this letter. I should have just posted it. And so that's what he did. He prayed, not just the once. He just kept praying until that relationship began to take a different direction. I talked about the tensions of ministry, of being a leader, of being a confidant, of being an employee. And I said to the minister, you will invest your heart and soul and you will talk about my members and my church, but actually this isn't your church and never will be your church. This church belongs to Jesus and he has delegated this task of pastoring to you. And he will come back looking for his return. You are a tenant. You're not an owner. And then I turned to the congregation and I said, my message for you is this. This is not your church either. And some of you have history in the church. You've been here a long time. You've made an investment in the place. We have one member here who at the age of 2 weeks was brought into the service here in the days when this floor didn't even exist. Beryl, this is back in 1925. She goes way back and over the years has been involved in so many things here, and lots of you have been involved and made investments in this church. Some may be content to be pew fillers, but others have invested time and money and service in this place. So if things head off in a direction that you're not particularly happy with, you'll inevitably be asking questions. Nothing wrong with that. But just be open to the thought that God may want to move in a direction that you're not comfortable with, because it's his church and it's not your church. Back in the day, in the sort of mid part of the 20th century, there were some very big churches in London. One of them was Westminster Chapel up near Victoria, where the minister was a man called Martin Lloyd-Jones, and he used to pack them in, very often 2,000 people in the congregation on a Sunday. And when he left, his successor had an awful time because he was just compared always with Martin Lloyd-Jones. And then you jump a few years to the 1970s, and along came an American called R.T. Kendall. And he decided that he didn't like the way the church was growing. The church was growing by people leaving their churches and coming to his church. And he thought, this isn't growing the church. We ought to be seeing converts. And so they started a program of evangelism, and they went out on the streets locally. And they had a lot of down and outs on the local streets, and some of those started to come in to the services. They smelt a bit rough and they sometimes sat quite near the front. And on one occasion, one of his deacons came to him and said, the people of quality in this church don't like what you're doing. And he'd just been preaching through James, the letter to James, you know, the letter from James saying, you know, you get a rich person come in the church and you get a poor person. You say, the rich person, come and sit here, and the poor person, go away. And it's there in the Bible. And yet somehow the people in the church didn't like the direction it was going. And so they were opposing. It was part of that kind of thing. This is my church. We don't like what's going on here. But no, it's not your church. It's Christ's church. Over time, you become attached to your church and you want to shape its direction. But always remember, this church is not yours. And deacon, even, you may be. Owner, you most certainly are not. And so I finished by turning to the minister and saying, Jeremiah, you've been appointed to the church to preach the gospel and promote the kingdom of God, and you will answer to Christ. And members, you are not called to be consumers of God's blessing as though the church is there to service your needs. You are called to be agents of that blessing. You too will answer to Christ. We are all called to be accountable. A while back, I shared the amusing story about four college students who were out partying late one night and didn't study for the test which was scheduled for the next day. In the morning, they felt pretty rough. They'd been drinking quite heavily. They were in no fit state to do the tests, and so they concocted a plan. They made themselves look grubby with grease and dirt, and then they turned up at the exam. And they went to the dean and said that they had attended a wedding the previous day, and on their way back, the car tyre punctured, and they had to push the car all the way back. In the morning, they were exhausted and in no condition to sit the exam. The dean looked sympathetically at them and thought for a minute, and then said to them that they could resit the exam 3 days later. Bingo. Plenty of time to revise and get it sorted out. They duly appeared before the dean at the agreed time 3 days later. He explained that as this was a special condition test, all four were required to sit in separate rooms. They all agreed, as they were now fully prepared for the questions that they would get. But when they opened their test papers, they discovered there were only two questions, carrying a total of 100 marks. The first question was worth 1 mark and said, "What is your name?" The second question, which was worth 99 marks, said, "Which tyre burst? Front left, front right, back left, back right." You can't pull the wool over God's eyes, you know? You will be accountable one day, and though you might be able to fool some people in life, we will all give account. The leaders of God's people in the days of Jesus had failed miserably. They had behaved like owners, not tenants. One day the Bible says, the books will be opened and we will all be judged for how we lived. Did we live with gay abandon, indulging our passions, or did we have an eye on what he requires of us? Even Jesus recognized that he was there to do the Father's will. He set his face like a flint to go to Jerusalem, the Bible says, and there for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising its shame, and is now set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Very often in life, it's people who inspire us, people who make choices and do things that we reflect on, and they're inspirational. One of those people was a man called C.T. Studd. There's a picture here. He was born into a rich family. You know, we need to jump forward a bit. Jump forward one at least. Nope, no joy. Okay, it'll come up eventually. C.T. Studd was one of three brothers, and they were all fairly close in age, and all three of them went to Cambridge University back in the early part of the 1880s. And as such, coming from privilege, they played cricket. And rather like the Ingebrigtsen brothers, Jacob, the younger one, you recall, who has been winning big races at the age of 18. C.T. Studd was the youngest of the three brothers and a brilliant all-rounder of a cricketer. In May 1882, the Australians, who'd been touring England and had won all 10 of their matches to that point, played Cambridge University. And it was a great day for C.T. Studd. He came in and batted and scored 118, and also took a hatful of wickets in the match. They won by a country mile in that particular game. He went on to play for England the following year and toured Australia, the return, and topped the bowling and the batting averages on that occasion. But in 1884, the following year, an almost fatal illness befell his younger brother, and it gave perspective to his life. He reflected that what had his brother got to look forward to if he were to die? He had grown up as a Christian, and he recognized that ultimately, for all our achievements and all of our joys, we have to give an account for how we've lived. And so he once wrote the words, "Only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last." And later on he wrote, "Some want to live within the sound of a church bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell." He had a fortune of £30,000, which translated into today's money runs into the millions. But he wrote out 10 cheques, five for 1,000 and five for 5,000, and sent them off to various Christian charities and mission organisations, and then spent nearly 40 years in China and India and on the African continent. And his sacrifice inspired a generation. So may our lives, he's the one in the middle, by the way, now that we got it back. So may our lives be lived well, and may we inspire others. May our attention be attuned to the one who has called us, and may his verdict on our lives be positive. In the fires of judgment, may what we do prove to be more than just wood, hay, and stubble. We often sing a hymn, "Take my life and let it be. Take my silver and my gold, not a mite would I withhold. Take my intellect and use every power as you shall choose. Take my love, my Lord, I pour at your feet its treasure store. Take myself and I will be ever only all for thee." May our lives be lived well, and may God find a return when he comes looking. We're going to sing a celebration of who Jesus is. He is the owner of our lives.